This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm your host, Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Millions of the world's very poorest family have been forced even closer to the abyss. Livelihoods are being destroyed at an unprecedented level.
That's the World Food Program's spokeswoman on the funding challenges to help millions facing death from COVID-19-related hunger and disease. Details coming up also. The trial for ousted Sudan leader Omar al-Bashir and 27 co-defendants was postponed today until August 11th. And President Trump and Egypt's President al-Sisi agreed yesterday on the need to maintain ceasefire in Libya. All these and more ahead on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. UN agencies say a lack of money is threatening the lives of millions of people in developing countries from COVID-19-related hunger and disease. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The United Nations recently appealed for more than $10 billion to help hundreds of millions of people in the poorest, worst-hit countries in the world survive the COVID-19 pandemic. Nearly half the amount of the updated appeal is slated for food assistance, with an additional $500 million to be spent on famine prevention. However, the international response has been tepid since the UN launched its first of three global humanitarian response plans for COVID-19 in March, asking for $2 billion. To date, only $1.7 billion of the $10.3 billion needed has been received. The UN warns the number of hungry people caught in a state of crisis could increase from the current 149 million to 270 million before the end of the year without international aid. World Food Program spokeswoman Elizabeth Beers says the agency's director, David Beasley, has warned the world runs the risk of a famine of biblical proportions.
Millions of the world's very poorest family have been forced even closer to the abyss. Livelihoods are being destroyed at an unprecedented level. Now, to prevent the worst, WFP is scaling up its operation to provide food assistance to 138 million people who face desperate level of hunger.
The UN Children's Fund runs humanitarian operations in 155 countries and territories. It says it has received less than half of the $2 billion it needs to support its activities for women and children. UNICEF spokeswoman Marixi Mercado says projections by the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health show COVID-19 is affecting children in ways that will have lasting or irreversible impact. She says the study shows 6,000 children could die from preventable causes every day over the next 6 months. This due to disruptions in essential services related directly and indirectly to COVID-19.
The data from the first 4 months of 2020 already show a substantial drop in the number of children completing three doses of the vaccine against diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis. We know that at least 30 measles vaccination campaigns were or are at risk of being canceled, and this, of course, could result in further outbreaks in 2020 and beyond.
The pandemic also is having a devastating impact on education. UNESCO estimates nearly 1.2 billion students in 150 countries are affected by school closures, causing mental and psychological distress for many. Another statistic from the UN Population Fund finds millions of girls and women are subject to violence due to COVID-19 lockdown measures. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Ousted Sudanese leader Omar al-Bashir and 27 co-defendants were in court today for the start of a trial over the 1989 coup that brought the iron-fisted ruler to power. The 76-year-old Bashir already has been convicted of corruption and is wanted by the International Criminal Court for alleged war crimes and genocide for the Darfur conflict in the 2000s. Wearing a traditional white robe and turban, Bashir and the other defendants, including his former vice president and several former cabinet ministers, were kept behind a steel fence during the brief proceedings, which were televised on state TV. The trial was adjourned until August 11th to provide time for defense lawyers to prepare their case and to find a larger venue after some attorneys complained their colleagues had not been able to get into the room. Police stood guard outside with AK-47 assault rifles, batons, and tear gas grenades. Bashir was ousted in April 2019 after months of protests. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi and U.S. President Donald Trump agreed yesterday on the need to maintain a ceasefire in Libya and avoid an escalation in the conflict there. However, Egypt's parliament has authorized the deployment of troops to Libya in a move that threatens a direct confrontation with Turkey, which supports a military advance towards the strategic city of Sirte by forces loyal to the UN-recognized Government of National Accord. VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shanawi discussed the possible scenarios in Libya with Wolfgang Poshtai, a security analyst at the National Council for U.S.-Libya Relations.
The intensity of an Egyptian, and I need to say Egyptian Emirate intervention, is not yet clear. This could range from a more symbolic warning shot, which probably would not have much impact, to a massive first strike with dozens of cruise missiles. What would be the follow-up if this could not stop the offensive? Would they be willing to continue with all this? If this ends in a more protracted war, the Egyptians could suffer from shortfalls of precision-guided ammunition for the Air Force, as their own stocks are quite limited. It's likely that the Saudis would help out with their stocks. Another shortfall is intelligence and concrete information about targets to be attacked by air. Egypt has just a few reconnaissance satellites, as Turkey. They would also need some support from others, from the Saudis, from the Emirates, but probably also from some other countries. With regard to Turkey, the most difficult challenge is the strategic location. Any kind of logistic support, any kind of deploying additional forces to Libya would need to pass by close to Egyptian territory, and they could be struck at ease. However, for Egypt, from my point, the biggest risk is how would their own population react to own casualties, especially if those casualties are mounting. Could there be also an escalation involving Egyptian territory, the Suez Canal? Would Egypt be blamed politically for the escalation by the international community? All these risks are probably more of significance for al-Sisi than the military risk.
But Egypt rejected a buffer zone in Sirte and al-Jufra. What is the alternative to avert an inevitable military confrontation with Turkey?
It is not finally rejected by the Egyptians. The reason for this is such a buffer zone would certainly serve also the Egyptian interest. Let me be clear. I don't see any likeliness that the Egyptians or the Emiratis would support Marshal Haftar in a new advance on Tripoli. So there is no way that the Libyan National Army would attack again towards Tripolitania. This means for Egypt, it would be sufficient to stabilize the situation at the front line, exactly where it is right now. If there would be a buffer zone, preferably with European peace troops, let me call it out, German peace troops, because I guess neither Egypt nor Turkey nor the Emirates would dare to attack German soldiers on the ground. This would certainly secure the Egyptian interests. They could be sure that no one would advance towards the east of Libya, no one would impose a threat on Egypt from Libya, and this would also give some space for political negotiations. This would also allow for an opening of the oil ports by paying the revenues, not as it happens right now, directly through the Foreign Bank of Libya to the CBL, but by paying them to some kind of escrow bank account, which means that the money would stay there until there is a solution about distribution of the oil revenue. Of course, part of the money would be needed to pay for the maintenance urgently required by the National Oil Corporation and maybe for some other health issues with regarding coronavirus or something like this. But the deployment of such a stabilization force would certainly serve the Egyptian interest. And I guess some people in Cairo have already understood this.
But did the European Union support the suggested buffer zone?
Actually, the German foreign minister, Heiko Maas, mentioned such a demilitarized zone. And I would say it's not unlikely that there is some discussion about this going on in the background. The European Union would have military tools, the so-called European Union battle groups, which would be perfectly suited for this task. The best solution would be, of course, if such a request would come out of Libya. So if the GNA and the House of Representatives would, after a ceasefire, request such an international stabilization force, I think this would help serving the interests not only of Egypt, but this would also help to serve the interests of most of the Libyans, as this would bring peace and stability, and there would be a chance for a real political solution.
That was Wolfgang Parshtay, a security analyst at the National Council for U.S.-Libyan Relations, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. Zimbabwe's government is redistributing some of the land that was given to new farmers after the violent farm invasions 20 years ago. This comes after low production and persistent droughts. Reporter Kuzaza Nawashi has the details.
Information Minister Monica Mutswangwa recently briefed the media on the plan after a cabinet meeting.
That the 255 abandoned land units and 112 vacant land units will be reallocated to deserving applicants. 24 farms under multiple farm ownership will be withdrawn and reallocated to deserving applicants. The 71 identified farms exceeding the maximum gazetted sizes will be downsized.
The changes come after massive land audit by government, which unearthed corruption and shocking abuse of power by officials. She says priority on redistribution will be given to war veterans, youth and women. While former white farmers, who are the subject of government compensation efforts after losing their land in 2000, have hinted that they are willing to farm again in Zimbabwe, government has not considered returning land to them. Agriculture Minister Perence Shiri explains the reason for limiting farm sizes.
There are a lot of our nationals, both here at home and in the diaspora, who are in need of land. The demand is overwhelming. As a result, the government came up with a policy of maximum farm sizes. As ministry, we will try as much as possible to stick to the maximum farm sizes. But however, we are very much alive to the fact that there are some highly productive units which, if disrupted, would definitely not augur well for our economy.
He adds that a productive farmer may exceed the farm size, but he emphasized it is a privilege government can review when it sees fit. Analyst Vivid Gwede says the changes by the government are an effort to right some wrongs.
The land reform program was marred by corruption and partisanship, which is why people who couldn't farm and who had no interest in farming except just owning the land ended up having multiple farms. So the government is trying to restructure the landscape of the agricultural sector in Zimbabwe.
Gwede says the government will need to do away with partisanship and corruption and award land to competent individuals who can ensure sustainability and make perennial food insecurity a thing of the past. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinavashi from Harare.
The United Nations Refugee Agency has moved hundreds of South Sudanese refugees in Uganda to a safer location following violence that broke out over accusations of stolen food. The clashes highlight the tensions caused by lack of funding and growing hunger among refugees. Halima Tumani reports from Kampala.
The violence was sparked by an incident July 13th in which youth from the Nuer community allegedly stole maize from the farm of the Kuku community in Palorinya, Obongi district, northern Uganda. Even though the perpetrators were punished, the situation escalated into violence. Three boys aged 16, 17 and 18 were killed. Seven others were wounded and some 280 shelters were set ablaze. The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, has relocated 762 South Sudanese refugees due to fear of retaliation attacks. 80% of these, according to the UNHCR, are children. Dunia Khan, the UNHCR Uganda spokesperson, tells VOA by phone that even though the tension has diminished, there is still a potential for more violence.
If 27% of the population do not see any hope and they don't have better chances of getting, you know, secondary schooling education, majority lack higher education and meaningful employment opportunities, then they are very vulnerable to be engaged in, you know, subversive activities or negative coping mechanism.
In April, the UN World Food Programme cut food rations in Uganda by 30%, which coincided with the coronavirus stay-at-home orders, which in turn affected those struggling to make ends meet, including refugees. The WFP warned that lack of food could force an already vulnerable group to resort to extreme methods to survive. Musa Echweru, Uganda's State Minister for Refugees, says it's unfortunate that these incidents keep happening, blaming it on South Sudan refugee leaders whom he says keep playing up tribal tensions. The Ugandan government has now resorted to using local radio stations in the community to promote peace.
Those sentiments continue to run very high among the Sudanese, unfortunately. So any small thing can trigger death. This is not the first time. One of the costs that we bear is to look after them and deploy a police force which is trained in human rights to make sure that apart from just enforcing law and order among these groups, they also are teachers and teach them how they must live among themselves.
Uganda hosts more than 1.4 million refugees, with South Sudanese nationals making up about two-thirds of the refugee population. The World Food Programme warns that the refugees will face further cuts in food rations unless the international community steps up and supplies the necessary funding. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
Less visible than COVID-19's physical threat is the mental illness that living with the pandemic can create or worsen. Experts say addressing the emotional challenges will be critical to getting past this stressful time. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke by Zoom with Yuval Nirioo, a professor of medical psychology at the Columbia University Medical Center and director of the Post-Traumatic Stress Program at the New York State Psychiatric Institute. Nirioo also conducted groundbreaking research on epidemics and mental health in the U.S. and West Africa during the Ebola outbreak of 2016.
Mental health really has a strong role. The threat is not only with regard to how our body deals with coronavirus. The threat is really also whether we are affected by the fear associated with the virus and whether we have enough support from our communities and families, whether we can trust our medical officers, politicians.
I know that mental health awareness and mental health treatment in some parts of Africa can sometimes lag behind the West.
Absolutely. I think the way some of the African countries treat mental health is a little bit outdated. I can tell you from my experience in Sierra Leone 6-7 years ago when I stayed there studying the impact of the Ebola epidemic, I was shocked to discover that in the entire Sierra Leone country, there is only one psychiatrist. And this psychiatrist was actually retired.
What do you suppose explains the shortage of mental health awareness and mental health treatment on the continent?
Part of it is because of the stigma. They don't speak about it. They try to hide it. They are ashamed. But really, there is no difference between physical health and mental health. You have fever, you treat the fever. If you are depressed, you have to treat the depression. It's as simple as that.
Treatment for mental health or any kind of therapy used to be stigmatized here in the States. I remember growing up in New York during the 60s and 70s, telling someone they needed a psychiatrist was an insult. Maybe it was the same for you growing up around the same time in Israel?
I remember those days, in my case, in the 70s and 80s, reaching out to mental health treatment, even in the context of war or terrorist event, was considered weakness. But it is not like that anymore. And I hope this will also be eventually the status in African countries where people will feel free to get help. And mental health will be also recognized by the government as an important resource to have for the citizens.
And I know that here in New York, and I guess elsewhere, healthcare workers who should know better often have trouble asking for help during COVID and other times.
Absolutely. You know, sometimes we forget what they are going through, especially in such a stressful times like now, where we have tens of thousands of COVID patients going to the hospitals and overcrowded departments.
So busy.
Not only busy, but also exposed to a lot of death and exposed to families who were terrified by the fact that they cannot really be with their loved ones. And some of them died at the end of a very painful hospitalization. So those medical teams are going through really traumatic events, and medical teams all over the world should be taken very seriously at this point, whether it's in Africa or elsewhere.
That was Yuval Nirioù, a professor at the Columbia University Medical Center and director of the Post-Traumatic Stress Program at the New York State Psychiatric Institute. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. In Ghana and West Africa, organic food is growing in popularity as people try to stay healthy during the COVID-19 pandemic. But organic produce is not easily regulated, and some consumers are paying extra for unverified claims. Farmers across the region are creating their own system with support from international bodies to certify organic produce. Stacey Knott reports from Accra.
Organic farmer Cobana Hudson grows about 40 different types of vegetables and fruits in Ghana. Up until about a year ago, the only way his customers could be assured of his organic practices was by trusting his explanations. But now, across Ghana, farmers like him are taking part in a participatory guarantee system. Farmers monitor each other to follow organic guidelines with spot checks, reviews of practices, and knowledge sharing. Their products are then certified organic to sell to local markets. Hudson is a strong proponent of the system. Before its introduction, he would have to explain his farm and practices to customers, even inviting them to visit the farm themselves.
With PGS, it's a certificate, so it's always easier if you can say that this body, hey, you can call this body, I'm registered with them, they've certified me. So that's why I definitely want the PGS to work.
PGS organic agriculture schemes are used across the world. This system is also used in Burkina Faso, Benin, Togo, Nigeria, and Senegal. PGS was introduced to Ghana in 2017 by an international organics organization, with Abosede Elawumi Benedict hired as Ghana's coordinator. While the scheme is in its early stages in Ghana, she hopes COVID-19, the disease caused by the coronavirus, will encourage more farmers to become interested.
Many people in Ghana just say, I do organic. And they don't really have the deep understanding of what organic is. So it's been a challenge, but we kind of see a new dimension with COVID-19. So many people really want to be sure now that what they are eating is actually, that has been labeled organic, is organic.
While there are other certification systems farmers can access in Ghana, these are expensive processes and aimed at export markets, Benedict says. Yusuf Musa Idrisa, a municipal crops officer working in the eastern region, is encouraging farmers to sign up with PGS.
PSG will really help the farmers because a lot of farmers shy away from certification. But if it is with the PSG, it's quite cheap and very, very affordable and friendly.
In West Africa, like across the world, there is growing consumer demand for organic food. While Simply Healthy in Accra sells mostly imported health foods and supplements, founder Ama Asafo Ajay says customers are asking for local organic products. Local organic certification would benefit producers as well as consumers here, she says.
People feel more comfortable just immediately looking and seeing that it's labelled organic, just gives them that peace of mind.
Both Benedict and Hudson are trying to encourage more farmers across Ghana to sign up to the system, which they say will benefit farmers, consumers and the environment. Stacey Knott for VOA News, Accra.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.